Gata Yoga. G-H-A-T-A, Gata means pot. So the yoga of the pot. And so the pot is essentially the body itself, but it's more particularly the torso. Now, the torso, this is a relic, a remnant of one of the influences of Indian alchemy on Hatha Yoga. And the torso is looked at as a alchemical retort, but it has two openings, right? It has an opening at the throat and an opening at the anus. So in order to maintain the energy in the pot, you've got to close the openings, right? Those are the two bandhas that you're using, is Mula Bandha to close the base of the pelvis and Jalandhara Bandha to close the throat. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So you've got the sealed pot. But those two bandhas also have another purpose, and that is you're combining the energies in the body in one particular place. Now, the energies, Radha was mentioning the vayus yesterday, the winds of the body. There's five major and five minor winds. And the major winds are localized in certain places in the torso, except for the Vyanavayu that circulates through the torso. Anyway, Pranavayu is located in the chest, and Apanavayu is located in the pelvis. That's why sometimes when you do the pose on your back, squeezing your legs into your torso, it's called Apanasana, and you're squeezing the Apanavayu. Anyway, the pranavayu tends to go up, and the pranavayu tends to go down. And what those two bandhas do then is move them in opposite directions toward each other. And then they move them down toward the abdomen. And then you have the third bandha coming in, Uddiyana bandha, which is Rani started talking about the pressure cooker. And that's what Uddiyana bandha does. It acts like a pressure cooker, compresses the combined energies, heats them up, and that's used to stimulate Kundalini. Does that make sense? Because if it does, I'd be surprised. That's the idea behind Hatha Yoga and Hatha Yoga Pranayama.
So translation of Vayu, spelling. Where does Pranavayu locate itself?
Yeah, that's a good point. You have to be able to distinguish between prana, which is suffused through the universe, and Pranavayu, which is in the chest.
So Pranavayu locates itself in the chest. How about Apanavayu? And when you do Jalandhara Bandha and Mula Bandha, what are you basically doing? Sealing the two apertures of the pot. Yeah. And you're in some ways forcing the prana down, and you're forcing the apana up, yes? And they're meeting somewhere. And then Uddiyana Bandha is actually the pressure that actually does what to those two values?
Heats them.
It heats them. Do you understand? You create a compression of molecules. Basically, you're going to get heat. So what did he say that this was the influence on Hatha Yoga? What did he say?
Indian alchemy.
It was Indian alchemy. Do you understand the idea of alchemy a lot?
Hatha Yoga has three purposes essentially. Number one is to enlightenment, whatever that means to you. And number two is to extend life beyond the normal span of years. Why is that? Because in the old yogas, the world was seen as a place of suffering, existential suffering, ontological suffering. In other words, as long as you were alive in a physical body, you were suffering. And so the purpose of those older yogas was to get out of life, leave it behind, because it was intractably suffering. Hatha Yoga was influenced by alchemy, but more than that, it was influenced by Indian Tantra, which was a rebirth or a revalorization of the feminine element. And the world then was seen as the body of the goddess. And it was not seen as suffering, it was seen as a beautiful place, which of course it is. It could be much more beautiful than we were such Indians at times. And so the old yogis, the Hatha yogis, didn't want to die. They didn't want to call the shots themselves. And so the, one of the purposes was to extend life beyond the normal span of years so they could enjoy a beautiful life. And the third one is very controversial, and that is to gain power. And you, if you've read the Yoga Sutras, you know about the Vibhutis in the third chapter.
And it's, how do you spell that?
Vibhuti?
Uh-huh.
Was that a test?
It is a test. For me,
V-I-B-H-U-T-I. Modern teachers will tell you that you're supposed to ignore the powers, that they're epiphenomenon. In other words, they happen, and they're indications of your practice advancing in the right way, but you're not supposed to do anything about them.
See, he always uses words I don't understand. Epiphenomenon. Could you please explain that?
It's something that happens. You're not trying for it. It just happens because it's an indication that your practice is moving in the right direction. However, there are some texts, old texts, that say that the yogis were trying very hard to create these powers, and there are indications that the Hatha yogins were very, very, very powerful men. And the great irony of modern yoga, right? And that there people were scared of them. That they had these powers. And now, whatever you think about the powers, we can talk about that at some point. It's very controversial. So there are texts that say that forget about the powers, but there are also other texts that say no, let's get as powerful as we can. Modern teachers will always tell you to forget about the powers, because why? They don't want a bunch of kook coming to their classes trying for powers. Iyengar actually even says in some of his writings that powers are an indication that your practice is moving in the right direction. So it's enlightenment, whatever that means, which I don't believe in, long life, and power. Those are the three goals of Hatha Yoga.
And when did Hatha Yoga begin to emerge?
Probably about the 10th or 11th century CE.
And Tantra was prevalent
a couple of hundred years before, yeah. So, yeah, we have how much time do we have time?
It is 10:10.
We have to 10:30 for this.
Yeah, you have an awesome class at 10:30. They need a little break.
No.
You're the teacher.
Oh, quick question. Did Iyengar have these powers?
Probably not. But I don't know that for sure. I
have to tell you that the powers that he did have were extreme powers of observation.
Observation, yeah.
Like extreme. Mm-hmm. And extreme knowledge of the human body and breath, which means, in my mind, he had some unusual capacities of also his mind. But he would be able to observe unusual things by having someone walk from the audience to the stage before he was going to correct
the poses.
We saw that, and it was literally almost like he was able to read the book of the body. You know how there's that new book, The Body Keeps the Score?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But just think if you could read the score. Mm-hmm. Just think if you were so good. You know, I'm interested in FBI agents right now, in being able to tell who spies are, right? Because they can read indicators. Iyengar was strangely gifted and strangely practiced. So it wasn't just a prodigy of a gift, which Krishnamacharya said he had as an asana teacher, but it was a prolonged study. 80 years maybe, really, yeah, basically 84 years of, well, no, because he was 14 when he met Krishnamacharya, so maybe 80 years, 85 years of extreme study. Like
so
extreme
could he read
study.
Disease? Like in other words, if someone were presenting
when I was over there in 87 and 89, he mainly taught the medical classes. His daughter and his son were teaching the public classes.
Oh, wow.
John Abbott, the chief editor, well, the owner of Yoga Journal for several years, went there, and he was in Tadasana, and Iyengar came up to him and said, "Hey, you doctors in class, come on over here." And he had never met John before. And he said, they said, "You doctors, tell me what's wrong with his right knee." You know, and the doctors were like, "Oh, well, I don't know. Let's go take an MRI." And he says, "Oh, you useless people." He's like, "He has a torn meniscus in his right knee." You know, and exactly the diagnosis. You know, but you have to understand, you know, like for instance, the Dalai Lama's physician can read ridiculous diagnosis through the pulse. What are they listening to? What are they, it's not magic. They've tuned themselves to hear, like, what did Bach hear?
Mm-hmm.
You think he heard what I'm hearing? You know, he's training himself. Not only does he have a gift, but he's also training themselves to be acting incredible listeners and observers. If you can train yourself how to observe better, your manual adjustments and stuff will be spot on. Your Shavasana adjustments, that's what I'm saying. At first adjust the basal skeleton, then, you know, adjust the skin, then adjust the muscle, then adjust the nervous system.
That's why you want to look at people on the street. When you walk down the street, none of that, of course, I was kidding before, but not in an invasive way. But if you're sitting in a restaurant and see somebody across the way sitting, just do it. Just, you know, not to make fun of them or anything like that. Just to feel what they're feeling. Or walk behind somebody on the street. You see feet turned out all the time. All sorts of funny things going on with the body. And get a feel for it. You just observe people during the day. Get used to that idea. And then when your students come to class, start looking at them right away. Not when class starts, but even before class, how they sit, how they walk into the room. So you're looking at people all the time, trying to relate it to yourself in some way.
Did you hear that last part? Relate it to yourself in some way. I think what Iyengar does when he reads bodies is he's spinning his body so well that he can imitate the person in front of him so deeply because he actually knows them through himself. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm.
There's some already connectivity with us that in some ways I can read you by not only emptying myself, but because I already have you inside myself.
Mm-hmm.
And by knowing myself well, that pattern that pattern is already understood by me understanding myself.